Hello, Geeky On listeners. This is episode 4. We have Jason Liu on the podcast. I was actually at Toronto Comic Con last weekend, for those of you aware or in the Toronto area. I don't know if you checked it out, but it was a good time. I had a lot of fun. I went on the Sunday. I heard it was a lot more lively on the Saturday. Sunday was cool, though. It was mellow. It's the way I like to go to a convention. I'm not good with the throngs of people, so I usually check it out on one of the more low-key days. But I had a good time. I kind of trolled through Artist Alley and, you know, saw what was happening. A lot of cool stuff. A lot of really cool stuff happening right now. While I was there, I actually got a chance to see Jason. Jason Liu is a guy that's been around the comic book scene in Toronto for a while. Like, I've heard his name. I've been aware of his work. But this is the first chance I really got to talk to him. So, you know, super cool guy, really nice. And I was like, hey, you know, want to do the podcast? And without any hesitation, he jumped right on it. So it was really great. It was really great at the convention. He was super great to stop in and do the podcast this week. And we're going to be talking a bit about his Kickstarter campaign, his awesome cosplay, which unfortunately you can't see on the podcast, but you got to check it out because this dude, he has a serious cosplay for multiple men. It's impressive. But yeah, it was a really fun podcast done in a different location. We actually recorded in sort of like a meeting room, and so there was like some reverb there, so sorry if it sounds a little different, but, you know, it's sort of a run-and-gun podcast, so there's going to be some quirks here and there. But it was a super, super great interview, and yeah, I'll leave you to check it out now. That's kind of a basic rundown of it, but yeah, so you've been doing comics for a little while, right? I mean, how long have you been doing your own stuff? You did Lou Harvest first, right?
Yeah, I've done other, like, I've been making comics since I was in high school. Like I was making mini comics and selling them in the cafeteria for $1.50.
Yeah, doing like the old school, like,
Xerox,
ash cans, yeah, kind of,
yeah,
stuff.
Black, oh, okay. And like getting friends saying, oh, cool coloring book. It's like, fuck you. I'm only 15.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Give me a break.
I can swear, right?
Oh, no, yeah, go ahead.
Okay,
just
sorry.
The table, yeah, that's one thing. No, that's, well, I mean, and that's part of it. I mean, you start out making rough stuff, but you know, people...
Well, everyone starts off that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to be a pro right out of the gate, especially in something like, you know, an illustrated medium or something. It's just, it's really tough. It's a skill. It's a skill that you hone, right?
Yeah. Like, I think in grade 12, I stepped it up a notch by having a colored cover to my comic.
and then I'm really going serious now.
Yeah. And then when they open it up, it's like, oh, it's still a coloring book.
So, no, it's not.
I know.
Yeah. But it's funny because, you know, people don't really get that, especially, you know, people that aren't aware of, you know, the comic book scene or whatever, is that, like, black and white comics are, you know, plentiful. You know, they're by far probably the most commonly published stuff as far as like independently published. But you know, if you're just looking at stuff that's on magazine racks and stuff, all you see is Marvel and DC. And
yeah.
That's all like beautifully colored, insanely, you know, like that glossy coat and everything. So yeah.
You don't see that many black and white comics these days. Well, not in the artist alleys of
conventions.
Well, like Fan Expo,
yeah.
Comic Con. Like you'll see more of that in the Canzine.
Yeah.
The Gladstone.
Yeah. That's, I guess that's a good point. I mean, there's actually, I would say
this those days. Yeah. Because, like, I remember the days where, like, yeah, like, I would have, like, yeah, like, these Black and White Zero mini comics, and you can just go around to tables and trade them with, like, other people. Yeah. But now, like, some people have stepped up notch. Like, there's just various different levels.
Yeah, well,
people take it,
and that's actually really
like
true,
like I'll trade you my dollar comic that I've printed out. It only cost me 30 cents. Well, here's your premium comic that's in color,
professionally bound. You know, like something that it cost them like $4 an issue just to print. Yeah, it's true. There is a real like sort of disparity there. Yeah, and I guess it. Comics, at least what I remember in terms of sort of earlier conventions and stuff, there was definitely more, almost like an underground zine vibe, even in artist alleys and stuff like that, where, you know, people were doing ash cans and stuff, they were just, you know, Xerox themselves. But you're right, and maybe that's a reflection on the convention sort of ecosystem here, more than anything, because it's grown dramatically.
Especially since, like, back in the day, like, the like to get a table at a convention, like, 15 years ago, only cost maybe $60 to $100.
Yeah.
But now it's, like, $400. So people have to step it up a notch in their, their game.
You kind of have to, be a certain level of professional, because, you know, it's a big investment just to put a table there. And then there's the expectation, or, you know, the hope that you're going to make some money out of it. So when you're putting that much up front, you know, you got to sell X amount of copies. And it's definitely a tough game. I mean, we're coming just off of Toronto Comic Con, you know, where I saw you there. And I was talking to a lot of people that they were kind of discouraged by sales and stuff like that, and they weren't necessarily selling as much as they would have hoped.
Do you know how much they were selling tables for at the Comic Con?
You know, I don't actually know offhand. Didn't look into it, or
no? Like I know it's $400 for Fan Expo, but I figured it'd be a bit cheaper.
You would hope so, because it's definitely a Toronto Comic Con is a smaller draw, like by a pretty wide margin.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting. I was talking about this at the convention. It definitely seems like something where they're going for more of a like a pop culture convention like Fan Expo. I mean, the big draws this year were people like Eliza Dushku, who's like. I mean, she doesn't really have much to do with comics so much, right? It's more like fan, like
sort of sci-fi.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I've noticed that this year. Well, just for that con alone, like they've put the celebrities in a far exclusive area.
Yeah. Well, it was a very different layout.
Yeah.
Than in the past.
Like, didn't give them like a big, broader, like front and center view, like Fan Expo. Like in previous years. Well, actually, last year's Fan Expo, they had their own spot, their own exhibit. But before that, like, it was, it was, like, the main big thing. And then, like, comics were shoved on the side. But I think, last weekend's Comic-Con, like, I think that the comics had a good prominent spot in the convention.
Yeah, I would certainly say that the artist alley was pretty well showcased. I thought that it was easy to access and all that, but, you know, we won't focus too long reviewing the convention. It's like, you know, 5 stars. This is fantastic. But, it was well set up, I think, all in all. But I just think it's definitely tough for artists, publishing comics, self-publishing comics. To sell books now. It's very competitive, that's for sure. You were at the convention as well, and you were cosplaying.
Yeah, I was not there selling my comics. I was there as part of the X-Men of Toronto, which is this cosplay charity group.
Cool. I was going to ask you about that, because, you're definitely... I've seen you at past conventions, and you have, like, this amazing costume. You're multiple man.
Thank you,
And it's fantastic, people can't obviously see this, but, like, you've got that cardboard cutout, like, with the photo sort of, like, replicas of yourself.
These foam core stand-ups of myself,
Yeah, exactly, and it's, like...
blown up.
And so you've got multiple versions of yourself. It's fantastic. Not to mention that the costume's spot on.
I take pride that I don't have to call myself the Toronto multiple man, because there's not that many multiple mans around.
That's a good point. Yeah, you picked a good character choice in that there's not a huge wanting to be that guy, which is too bad because, man, like, Multiple Man's awesome. Madrox, like,
oh yeah,
that actually there was a, like that one book that there was like sort of a offshoot, like he got his own run.
I think mini series that led up to X-Factor.
Yeah. Exactly. Man, that book was fantastic, and it was like it. I remember reading that and totally blindsided me because it was like a pulp noir kind of story. It was a like a detective story.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, then they threw in all the cool, weird, mutant, like X-Men sort of elements to it. But at its heart, that's a really cool sort of crime drama, like, you know, sort of crime story.
Thanks to Marvel Knights, like, they always add that kind of dark twist to the to titles, and yeah, it's great that they gave him like a rebirth, like after he survived the Legacy virus.
Yeah, so was that the point? Like, were you already a huge fan of him before the X Factor sort of run, or?
I think I had an attachment to him back in the early 90s when you know people were still collecting the trading cards, like the
yeah, I remember the trading cards,
yeah,
the old Fleer cards and everything, and
like. He kind of stood out to me because he wore a trench coat and Gambit was very popular at the time and
yeah,
and
loved Gambit.
And
he was like the icon of the X-Men of the 90s. Like,
yeah. but the thing is, like, I like characters that are not in the spotlight. They're a bit fringe characters. So I kind of lean more to him. But once I, you know, when I was picking up a few issues of X Factor back in the 90s, like, I found myself a bit more connected to him.
Yeah.
Since we're both only, I'm an only child, just like him. And there was this one, I remember that there was this one page where, this was like after he died from the Legacy virus, and Maura McTaggart's like looking at his room and just seeing or not fantasizing him, but like just imagining like what he was doing in the room where he was like just multitasking. He was like painting and playing music and all that stuff. And it's like that's like I kind of connected to that because like it was like I kept myself occupied when I was like an only child. Like, I didn't have any siblings to entertain me. So
you kind of just were like omnidirectional. You're just kind of going and doing all kinds of different stuff. That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always interesting when you have like those characters that you really sort of relate to as a kid. And yeah, I know, like, I think the X-Men is one of those awesome series because it's kind of got a character for everyone to relate to.
Exactly.
You know? And you know, like, for me, I know Beast was one of those characters that I really resonated with because it's like, I mean, I was a big kid growing up, and like I always kind of felt a little bit like kind of alienated and stuff. And here's a dude that was like, he was wicked smart. He was like, he had so many admirable sort of characteristics and stuff, and he was a very altruistic character. But he also kind of just didn't quite fit in because he was always really self-conscious about the way he looked and his image, and like he always wanted to change the way he looked. And that's something that, like, I mean, it's kind of what the X-Men is all about, and that it's disenfranchised characters that, you know, like,
exactly.
That's why it resonated with us when we were kids, right? It's like your teenager or whatever, and
like,
you're just
like,
you
didn't have to be like,
gets me,
an alpha male bodybuilder to be a superhero.
Yeah.
Like, you can just look at like those characters, like they all have their own like unique qualities.
Yeah, and yet it still resonated with everyone for some reason. It's not like you know, the alpha male dude bros are like, no, I totally hate Wolverine, man. It's like, no, everyone likes the X-Men. It's just one of those really, really successful franchises, but it's not exactly a revelation, is it? But no, it's really cool the way that you have that sort of set costume that you're kind of iconic, at least in Toronto, as being like that cosplayer. And you're not the only one. There's actually several. I know, like, there's a Toronto Rogue, there's Toronto, I think there's a Gambit, right?
Yeah.
So there's,
we have,
there are all those guys.
Nightcrawler, Psylocke.
Oh, wow. And I mean, I know it goes outside of the X-Men that there are people that sort of identify as the Toronto, you know, like, superhero of choice, but what is the deal then with the Toronto X-Men? Like, I guess you guys are sort of a cabal of sorts. You guys are like a group.
Yeah, well, like, we're just a group of individuals that share the same passion and not just cosplaying, but cosplaying for a purpose, which is just doing charity work.
Cool.
For various organizations around the community. Like we've helped out for the Daily Bread Food Bank a number of times, actually. Like
yeah.
We did a food drive. We actually did two food drives for them, and we also raised money to run a 5K with them at the Scotiabank Waterfront Marathon. Yeah,
that's awesome. That's really cool. I mean, that's a really
running
a costume thing.
Yeah.
Oh man, that
it was amazing.
Really
it's,
yeah,
yeah.
And I mean, that's a fun thing for anyone. You know, like anyone like checking out the event too, and like it raises awareness, obviously, because bunch of people running around in costumes. I mean, that's...
Yeah, well, and it's, you know, aspiring to be role models to just young fans.
To kids, yeah, of course, yeah. So that's really cool. I mean, that's good. I mean, it takes it beyond the already really, like, fun and worthwhile element of cosplay for conventions and stuff, which is a really cool pursuit in itself. But then you guys actually turn into something else in terms of it's become its own thing and become a positive force in its own right. That's really cool. I admire that.
Exactly.
So I'm curious then, like, I mean, with a costume like yours, it's really well made.
Thank you.
Like, was that a particular interest of yours, like costume design or anything like that? Or, like... I'm not much of a cosplayer, so I'm always curious to talk to people that really
are. It actually started out as a Halloween costume.
Okay.
It was an idea I came up with right before the Silver Snail Halloween party. They organized like one of the best Halloween parties in Toronto. So like if you don't have any plans for Halloween, but you're a comic nerd that wants to dress up, go to the Silver Snail party. It's awesome. There's a lot of creative costumes there. I always wanted to do a multi-man costume, but just never figured out how until it just popped in my head. Just to like,
other than finding a couple other people that look like you and be like, hey, do you want to hang around me for an evening?
But the thing is, like, I like doing things on my own as well.
Of course, yeah.
So, like, just like multiple man. So it was either like to find mannequins, which would be very heavy for me to carry.
Yeah.
Or yeah, like what I have right now, which is the foam core standards.
Which is yeah, it's a very clever solution. Although you obviously overlooked one, which is making robots. So I mean, I guess you're a little lazy.
Yeah, I don't have a robotics degree or anything.
Well,
like that.
You know, with that attitude.
Well, you know, Matrix is not a engineer of sorts.
That's
well, unless one of his dupes
yeah,
is.
Yeah, exactly.
But then the thing is, like, his other dupes counterbalance that. Or
yeah, yeah. That's a cool element, though. Like, again, that miniseries, which, yeah, if anyone listening to this wants, it's just Madrox, or Madrox, and it's Marvel, it was the Marvel Knights series. It was, like, early 2000s that came out.
Yeah, like mid-2000s.
Yeah, like, I'm sure you can find the trade on, like, Amazon.
By
or
Peter
Comic
David
Shop.
And
yeah.
Sam, can't pronounce his last name.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, sort of weird.
Art.
Yeah, but it's fantastic. Anyone listening, check it out, give it a read. And then it went on to X-Factor, which another local artist, Leonard Kirk, worked on for a long, long
time.
Yeah. Which was really cool. Leonard's a super
I really enjoyed his work. It's, like, his art, like, got really tight because... I found the X Factor series went through a number of artists, some were pretty good. Like at the start, like they had a good tone to it, but then around like Secret Invasion, they brought the artist that did X Factor from like the 1990s. Because it kind of had like that 1990s like image feel to
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that like lots of lines and
but yeah, but,
yeah, like
but the thing was like
everywhere.
Yeah, and just very exaggerated.
Yeah.
Anatomy, but
dynamism, you could say.
Yeah.
Just, like, weird
life
dynamism. Yeah, life. Oh God.
Nothing wrong with that. If you dig that, that's fine. But
you know what? I'm just gonna go ahead and say there is something wrong with that. I think Rob Liefeld's art is terrible, and it always bugs me when someone says they like it.
Yeah,
but, you know,
it's not my cup of tea.
We won't get into a hate fest about that. I'll just say that he should learn how to draw every part of the human body and not forget about feet.
Exactly. Like, getting back on track, they were changing a number of artists where it was kind of like there were, like, at least the author, I mean, Peter David was the only thing that kept it consistent, but it seemed like...
And he had a long run, too.
Oh, yeah. He did the whole thing.
Yeah, which is amazing.
No breaks.
It's rare that you see a writer get that opportunity on a book to run for years. And he did. So he got to tell a really complete story with X-Factor, which was really cool.
Leonard Kurt was the one that, like, just...
Yeah, he really stuck on the book.
Yeah.
Right? He was on it for a number of years. I didn't actually realize that they had such a sort of merry-go-round of artists on it, though.
Yeah.
But I didn't follow the series that closely, admittedly. But that's really cool. And I know that Leonard did have a really long run on it. And that's right. He finished up the book, I believe.
Almost.
Really?
Yeah. No. Like they had one story arc which was called The End of X Factor, and he passed it on to someone else whose artwork was almost similar to Leonard Kurt. So it complemented it, but he's no Leonard Kurt.
Yeah.
Like, I would have preferred Leonard Kurt, but no offense to the other guy. Like, the other guy was great, but
yeah. Well, I mean, it's one of those things, especially when he was running on the book for as long as he was. You would hope you would get that last story, but you know what?
There's only like six more issues to do.
It happens.
Yeah.
It happens. And now he's on to other awesome stuff with Marvel. I think he's doing like
Fantastic Four. Yeah.
Amazing.
He's killing it.
Yeah. And man, that guy is just, he is the most nice, soft-spoken guy. Like, I've met him a few times now, and yeah, really pleasant. Plus, his Facebook is awesome.
Yeah.
There's few people I've ever seen that, like...
He always points out, like, something negative in the internet world.
But
he
finds, the humor in it.
Yeah, no, for sure.
But, yeah, we could probably spend the whole podcast talking about how awesome Leonard Kurt is.
Well, yeah, we'll have to have another episode.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd like to be in that podcast.
There we go.
Over.
If I manage to get Leonard to do the podcast, I'll just bring you along and be like, well,
I'll dress up in my Madrox costume and talk. Even though the audience won't even know the difference.
But it's probably the only way he'd agree to do it. No.
Awesome. Yeah.
But talking about comics, let's get back to, you know, your drawing comics. And I know the thing that definitely, as far as I became aware of you, was Lou Harris.
Awesome.
Talk about that a bit.
So, me being a huge Star Wars fan, after watching some episodes of like Clone Wars and playing the video games and stuff, I was like, man, wouldn't it be awesome for me to like live in that universe or live like just experience like some of the environments like in Star Wars? And so Loot of Harvest was a way to put myself in
that
the Star Wars
universe.
Yeah, really, this was a project that I just did for myself, but and if other people dug it, like, that's awesome, because this was, it started off as a one-shot that took place, like, a few years before A New Hope. It's called Defective, where it talks about, it follows a defective clone, who later goes AWOL successfully.
Okay.
And
he just leaves the clone army.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
And after like all those conditioning about like you gotta be loyal to the Empire, like there was like some kind of defect to him where
he
wanted to
get brainwashed kind of thing?
Yeah, he wanted to like live his own life.
Yeah.
Like outside of the military. He became like a pacifist. And it's funny because there was this Hasbro action figure of a clone pilot, and he has like this aviator's cap, and I have the same same gray aviator's cap, and I took a comparison photo of myself in that cap and that action figure, and like all my friends agreed,
yeah,
but we were spot on. And it's like so I use that character, which looked like me.
Yeah.
Later on, it just branched out into just Blue Harvest Chronicles, which was an autobiographical web series where I just took... It started off where I just captured all of my horrible dating experiences, my breakups, and...
Yeah, and just apply them to the Star Wars?
Exactly,
that's
yeah.
Awesome. That's
yeah.
such a clever like way to sort of mask... telling personal stories. And, you know, it allows you to reach an audience that maybe wouldn't be, like, into that sort of a story. Like, you know, slice of life kind of comics or something like that, you know? Like,
exactly.
The people that are going to go and pick up, you know, something from Top Shelf aren't necessarily the people that are going to go and pick up something from Dark Horse and get a Star Wars book.
Mm-hmm.
But you managed to find a way to sort of marry the two kind of concepts together. That's a really clever thing. And to be honest, I don't really know too many other people doing stuff like that.
Yeah, it was very cathartic, therapeutic as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, throwing my passion for Star Wars just brought a positive light to all those, like, embarrassing moments I had.
Yeah, I guess it allowed you to sort of step away from those experiences and sort of put them through that lens and in a way, I guess, deal with it, like, you know, sort of deal with it on your own as well. That's really cool. Yeah, it's funny, actually, the last person I had on the podcast, Cena, we were talking about, he just released a book as well that's it's called Self-Obsessed, where it's like personal stories and stuff like that. I mean, it's the most obvious place, you know, to go for ideas. It's like, it's right there. It's your life. And no one's going to be able to tell
us. Yeah, right what you know,
right? Yeah. And yeah, no one can tell your stories.
Yeah.
So there you go. Like, did you find that was like an easier way to tell stories? Or did you actually find it was more challenging than, say, like just coming up with some yarn, like some plot?
The writing came easier for me. It was more exploring the Star Wars universe, trying to translate that story into the right environment of Star Wars. And you know, when you look at Star Wars movies, like, you only look at the war aspect, but
yeah.
When you follow my character, who's not really that combatant, he's... Like, you'll find him in numerous bars and nightclubs,
yeah,
or whatever. So, you know, like, I just had to, like, do a lot of research, looking at, like, Ralph McQuarrie's artwork, like, some of the concepts that were not used for, like, Cloud City, because most of the stuff in the story takes place in Cloud City. He finds refuge there.
Just hanging out in Bespin.
Yeah. Well, that's a great place to escape from the Empire until Empire Strikes Back.
Exactly. It's true, right? It was sort of like that bootlegger town or, like, you know, where everyone was just sort of trying to lay under the cut.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's cool. And now, you mentioned research. That was actually what I wanted to ask you. Like, now, did you find you have to do a lot of research as you were going along, or were you already just, like, a huge fan of the sort of surrounding fiction of the Star Wars universe?
Both. Okay. Like I read the novels and seeing, just getting a sense of the idea of the planets of you know, like the do's and don'ts. Like, I didn't want to be, like, too extreme by putting like a neon colored bar in Tatooine, because
right.
That won't work. But you would probably find that in like Cloud City for sure.
Yeah,
and Coruscant. And also, since, like, Star Wars was inspired by, like, other sorts of, like, sci-fi material, like art by Mobius and stuff like that. So I was looking at some other things that inspired
me. So you were really going down the rabbit hole, and you were finding not only the concept art of Star Wars, but even the concept art that influenced the concept art of Star Wars.
Exactly. Yeah,
okay,
cool. And when you look at Clone Wars, like, the cartoon series, like, they even, like, branch out and, like, just do... they would tie in, like other movies, other movies that are not, like, science fiction, but they would just have their own Star Wars twist to it. Like, I don't think if they did like a like a like taking a story like Sister Act, but like for example, like they would take like a script to Sister Act, and they would try to make that into like a Clone Wars episode, throwing in like.
I mean, let's be honest. The Sister Act is probably the most easily adaptable modern film to be adapted to the Star Wars universe.
That's the only thing that came to the top of my head. But that's an easy one.
Come on.
Oh no, no. The Kurosawa films. Like Kurosawa like was a huge inspiration to the Star Wars universe, and. Like seven, they did an episode similar to Seven Samurai.
Yeah.
Where, but it was just, you know, they had to throw in Star Wars elements. So I did the same thing where I was like, I saw like Tron Legacy, and I'm a huge Daft Punk fan. So I was like, man, I want to like make a club that's kind of like that.
That whole scene. And okay, that's cool. So yeah, you were finding inspiration from all kinds of like, you
know. As long as it kind of looked like it came from Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's cool. Yeah. See, that would have, it's funny, I didn't even realize they were doing that with episodes and stuff, but that just makes my mind run. You know, all I can think about is a Weekend at Bernie's episode. I don't know how they pull that off, but
they're trying to pop up.
It's like we're gonna have a party.
I think they did something similar to that. Like there was one episode which was kind of like a Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis feel, where like Jar Jar Binks was the Jerry Lewis and Bail Organa was the Dean Martin. He was a straight man.
Wow.
And they were like in a diplomatic mission.
Wow, that must have been a fun show for them to write for, right, when you think about it.
Yeah, and Jar Jar Binks was tolerable.
Yeah.
Well, because he was in his natural environment, which was an animated.
Yeah, exactly.
Series.
Unlike a feature film where he was in a cartoon in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, episode one. But yeah, so I mean that inspired quite a bit of content from you. I mean, how much did you end up making of Blue Harvest in total?
Maybe about like 60 pages. Actually, I think it was like 50 to 60 pages for Blue Harvest Chronicles, and then Defective, which started it, was about 20. So 80 pages. And the thing is, like, each page is heavily rendered. Like
Full color. It's beautifully, yeah, like it's beautifully realized, and like it has a very professional look to it. I have to say, as a piece of independent work that wasn't released for commercial, you know, gain or anything, it was just a, like you said, a personal exercise.
Yeah,
it's fantastic work. It's really impressive.
Thank you. That's definitely one of my proudest work, because. Like, I just wanted to go full out and just push myself to the limit. And so when I can look back at it in, like, 10 years from now, I can say, yeah, that still looks good.
Yeah. No, and I think that that's a tough thing for any artist to do. And to be honest, in all reality, you probably will, to a certain extent, be saying to yourself, oh, I can't believe that's what I did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
That's where you're going to be. You know, but it's one of those things where if you can at least create a product that stand behind in that time and be able to say, like, look, this is as good as I'm going to make it, you know, with the skills I have right now, then, like, what else can you ask for? And I think even at that point, you know, when you look back on it, you know, you'll see the flaws, you'll see all the problems with it, but at least you'll be able to say, it's like, you know what? This is what I was at that point in time. There was no shortcut. There were no shortcuts. There was no half-assing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a good thing to do. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to find the time. How did you find the time?
I made time.
Fuck you for saying that.
it's you know, like, there's less sleep for sure.
Yeah.
I'd work my 9-to-5 shift. That's like in the library, and then come back home and put 5 hours that day. Or if I was working in a 1-to-9 shift, like, I would put some time in the morning and most at night once I get back home. And then like Saturdays and Sundays, like, I found myself not going out that much with my friends. Like, I'd probably only do that like once a month.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, the fun thing about that is, like, Like after working 5 hours on a Saturday night, I'll treat myself by going out to downtown to BMV Books, which is open until like 12 a.m.
Yeah.
And I'll just buy like some fantastic art book that would keep inspiring me to keep fueling for
more. Kind of fuel, you know, stoke that flame to keep you invested and keep you interested.
Exactly. Like, that was my only passion, which was my webcomic, like nothing else.
Well, I can honestly say that passion is the only word I can think to describe that, because shit, I know I try, like, with this podcast and with my writing and, you know, just with all kinds of projects, because I'm a total fucking scatterbrain. I'm the kind of person that I have a lot, like, I have, at any given time, I have four different things on the go. And, you know, half of the things I'm going to bail on, and then the other half I'm going to try and get done, and some are going to go slowly, but... Like, that passion for one thing, that's really hard to find. I know I struggle with
it. I even said no to some, like, freelance gigs.
Wow.
Because I was like, no, like, I'd rather do Lou Harps because that made me more happy. And especially since they didn't really pay that well
on
your job.
Well,
so was it really worth it for... Was
well,
it worth my time?
What do you expect to make? Money?
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah, that's an unfortunate truth of freelancing. You know, as a freelance artist, it's hard to get paid well. It's hard for people to value your work well.
Especially in Canada. Like, in the States, they pay you very well compared to Canadians. Yeah.
See, that's not something I was very aware of. I feel like right now, at the time we live in, is almost problem. Like, it's a problem for artists, because I think there's sort of a sense of like a devaluation of, you know, sort of people's work, because there's a lot of bastardization going on. You know, like, there's a lot of people just sort of grabbing what they, stealing bits and pieces and stuff, and, you know, because the internet makes, you know, art so readily available.
Right.
And, you know, for me,
like scripts.
Oh yeah. Right. Well, did you hear there was that one story? Are you talking about the one with the web strip or whatever that was stolen or whatever, like distributed more widely? Or sorry, what are you referring to?
Bit strips is where like anyone can just
submit stuff, kind of.
Well, make their own comics of themselves.
Oh right, and that's the stupid. I hate those.
Where anyone can be a cartoonist.
Exactly, and everyone thinks it's just that easy. You know, it's like, no, your comic, like, those comics look stupid and they're thoughtless and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, it's like a live journal, but put in a comic format where it's like, hey, I'm going to document that time where I just slipped on ice.
Yeah.
And then they take, like, maybe, I don't know how long it takes them, like, maybe 30 minutes to, like, pose themselves, like, slipping on ice and have that static, shocking, oh, no, I slipped on ice.
Yeah.
And it looks, it looks like a Marmaduke cartoon.
Oh,
it's stupid.
It's paper puppet play, right? Like, that's it. You know, you're just turning, like, moving a little puppet around. And that's a perfect example of something where, you know, the internet says, this is all you have to do to make a webcomic. So that's simple. No, that's not what making a webcomic is. You know, like, there's nothing personal about it. It doesn't have perspective. It's you telling a funny anecdote and then, like, putting, like, a little puppet, you know, in a position. It's just...
Yes.
And that's, you know, like, making a webcomic, that's a lot of work. That's a lot of time. And it's a skill that you hone. Drawing is not easy, and it doesn't come overnight, right?
For sure.
I think it is tough for freelancers to be able to get their work properly valued. In the kind of age we live in. What I was actually thinking of when you had first said something was that there was an article recently that went out that there's this webcomic strip, and I feel like an idiot because I don't even know what it is.
Okay.
I just, like, it's about life. The title is, like, Life with Cats. So it's, like, you know, life, you know, like, doing this with a cat. And it's, like, you know, there were about four panels, like, you know, sort of four panels with the juxtaposition of with a cat, where the cat's kind of interfering. And after, like, in either,
like
in the outro, I'm gonna link it. I'll make sure people know and get proper accreditation for that. But essentially, she did a sort of an experiment, and she kind of they did their best to track how many copies were distributed with the proper accreditation, where, you know, the link to the website was actually linked,
mm-hmm.
and how many weren't, where it was cut out intentionally. And it was staggering. It was staggering how many people were distributing this comic strip without any information, even though it was like it was tagged on the image. It was cut out and distributed way more widely than the one that actually had the
product. And they cropped out the artist's credit.
Name, yeah, exactly.
You know, that reminds me, because a friend of mine, Atlanta McCarthy, like she's been drawing these cat paintings. And like she's been like rocking it at Fan Expo, making a lot of money on painting these cats as superheroes.
Okay.
And then they just became internet memes for some reason. It just blew up.
Because
and,
it's cats. That's
yeah.
Why.
Yeah.
The short answer is internet memes plus cats equals yes.
But it was so out of her control,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, of course.
It just blew up.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's like widely distributed, and maybe a tenth of the people that see that image know that she did it. And that's like that was at least the sort of rough numbers that webcomic had determined.
Uh-huh.
And that's crazy. You know, it was like a half million to like 30,000, you know, like of people, you know, and I'm butchering the numbers,
but that's totally not exactly for the artist that created that.
Yeah, because it's like
people won't even know who was behind that. Which
it's like people will be sharing. It's like, oh, this is great, and you're like, yeah, that's great that people like it. Except for it'd be nice if people actually knew that I made it, and not only that they should have known, but someone along the line actually went out of their way to make sure people didn't know. And yeah, part of that apparently is like sites like I think 9gag and stuff like that. They actually will crop the artist information out because they want to get more click throughs and stuff like that. So they want to make sure people stay on their page.
Like,
because I guess the thinking is, if you see who made it, maybe you'll want to see more of their work. Which isn't that a good thing?
It should be.
Yeah, but. Apparently there are sites that do that, and any sites that do that are douchebags. And I don't want to specifically, like, I think it said 9gag. I don't want to say that definitively because, you know, maybe they're one of the good guys, but, you know, any site that does that or like anyone that's doing that is pretty shitty. Like, that's a shitty thing to do.
Horrible.
Yeah. But, it's really, like, I mean, the internet has really created an environment where artists aren't necessarily appreciated for the effort that goes into their work. And I know, like, with pages like you were doing on Lou Harvest, fully rendered, full comic book size pages, really.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that must have taken, days to put together? Or like
Like, how it worked out was, I would plot the script on a Monday and then do the rough pencils on Monday, and Tuesday I'll do the final pencils, and Tuesday and Wednesday I'll ink it, and then from Thursday to the weekend it's all coloring, because that's where it takes a lot of time.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's heavily
with pencils, but I guess color is a very involved process because it's all about refining, right? It's all about
finding the right lighting and just digital brushwork.
So, in your writing process, do you write sort of loose and you just sort of tell the story in the images? Because I mean, you're a pretty visual person. Would you consider yourself an artist and illustrator first, or a writer first, or both?
Both. I think they're both the same. Like I was doing apprenticeship with Larry Hama at one time, and he told me this one thing where it's like you should be able to look at a page without the words and already know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I approach making comics, just drawing out the panels, like as if you're doing it like a Marvel's Nuff Said issue.
Right. Okay, yeah. that's a
like just the silent issue of G.I. Joe.
Yeah, that is a great way to look at it. And I guess really the main thing you want to plot out as far as like when you're storytelling is you want to know what is taking place in the scene, like in the page.
Yeah.
And then from there, stuff like it's almost kind of Marvel method, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're like, this is what's going to happen, and then I'll get the dialogue in there, you know, once.
Everything back in the day was, as Larry Hama said, because, he's, like, from the old school Marvel days.
Yeah.
Like, everything was, inspired by like old cinematics, like if like a Kurosawa film or Ingmar Bergman film.
Which is, I mean, it's a excellent medium to ape from because, I mean, as a visual medium, classic film, like, you know, older cinema really did perfect the element of storytelling visually.
Exactly.
So, I mean, especially someone like Bergman and Kurosawa, who are, I mean, masters of film, really. Like, best of all time.
And Hitchcock was another.
Those are fine examples to be drawing from, for sure. I mean, you could do, like, Orson Welles, too. I mean, like, so many visual storytellers during that era. That's essential is that, you know, a film like that can stand alone with nothing but complete silence and visual imagery.
And trying to, like...
And really, it's the writing just... It adds on that. It's just another level of, you know, of richness. But...
Exactly.
Like you said, the story can stand alone with the visuals, and it should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, okay. So, I guess that was the way that you approached it. That's a really cool way to do it. I mean, have you ever thought about collaborating with another, like, with a writer or an artist? Or are you really more of a cartoonist?
I'd say a cartoonist. I love doing things on my own. I'm a control freak. It's so... And the thing is, if I were to do anything wrong in that comic, at least I can be fully accountable for it.
Sure.
But yeah, once in a while, I would collaborate with a fellow writer. I'm not really a writer myself. I don't even write scripts. I just like how I write my comics is I would have an idea for the story, and then jot down events in that story in chronological order, and then later on fill those events with like dialogue and just more detail to it, and then and that's how I just start with my first draft, just be a bit more, just expand on those events as much as I could, and then just cut out whatever is necessary or rearrange certain scenes, but it's all like just jot down in my sketchbook. I don't even type.
Yeah, it's
my computer.
The way you describe it, it's like fitting puzzle pieces together almost.
Yeah.
So you just sort of, like, you know, these are the blocks of information that you need to convey, and then it's just a matter of sort of fitting them together and kind of telling, that's how you, like, the story gets built out. And that's cool. I mean, it's interesting, storytelling, especially in a visual medium, is something where, I mean, and it applies in comics as much as it applies in television and film, it's... There's not a clear cut way to go about telling that story from a plot standpoint. I mean, you can kind of get there through a lot of different means, especially when you have visuals to help you tell that story. I mean, writing, say, a novel or something that's much more based on the page. And we're talking obviously about like print page, not comics, but that's something where you really have to take a reader through sort of like a literary journey. I mean, you can't. It's people have done it. They play jazz or whatever, and they just sort of go. But it's from telling a plot or a story or something. You can get away with a lot more visually by just say doing a panel with just a particular image than you can in writing, where you kind of have to know, you have to be talking about something all the time.
Exactly.
Sounds stupid to say, but like...
When I'm doing like a project where I'm both the writer and artist, at least I'm able to skip that step of writing a script because I already know visually what is going to happen as I'm writing down the script.
Yeah.
Which I'm not really typing that script.
But just jotting down notes. Okay. Well, that's really cool. I mean, that's a really different... Like, I mean, it's a different process than the kind of way that I would approach storytelling. But I will absolutely identify myself as a writer first. I mean, I have some drawing experience, but I consider myself pretty neophyte in that regard. And, you know, as far as the way I approach it, just like mentally, the way I just sort of wrap my head around a story is like, I want to just tell it first. Like, I don't see it in my head quite so much. It's not until I really start really thinking on the story that I've put together and all the plot points that I start to see how I want to put together visually. So it's interesting. I mean, there really are so many different ways that you can kind of go about it. But I mean, speaking of your storytelling, I mean, I'm curious, like, are there, you mentioned, sorry, what was the fellow's name? The quote about showing everything on being on the page.
Larry Hama.
Larry Hama, yeah.
The guy that did G.I. Joe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and he was an editor for Marvel at the time, and he also worked on The Nam and wrote for Wolverine.
Oh, okay, cool, yeah. Cool. I
did all the file cards for all the G.I. Joes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So yeah, he was I
was a huge G.I. Joe fan.
Yeah,
so.
Through the like sort of the military stories of Marvel, and what would that probably like the '70s and eighties kind of era or
early '80s.
Early '80s, yeah.
G.I. Joe was meant to be a Nick Fury Shield series, but
they got the licensing for G.I. Joe, so
yeah,
they did that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, other than him, were there other sort of influences in terms of books or anything like that, in terms of how you learned to do comics, in terms of what kind of people inspired you, and how did you sort of learn about the medium?
Back in high school, I was a big fan of the X-Men and Joe Madureira.
Yeah, Joe Madureira, who's like, you know, king of one of the kings of '90s like sort of art, comic art.
Like he brought like the North American manga style.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But later on, like as I went to like I studied in Sheridan College, like I leaned more towards alternative comics, so. Adrian Tomine of
yeah.
Optic Nerve was
yeah.
a huge inspiration to me, because to be exposed to comics where like you can tell a story that are not about superheroes but just average people
for sure,
dealing with real things. So that was a huge inspiration. But I think Larry Hama was the biggest influence to me because. I had this great opportunity to communicate with him over Skype and like show him some of my work.
Oh wow!
And he was a harsh critic. Like this was like after I studied Sheridan College.
So what did you take at Sheridan? Just
illustrations,
okay.
Interpretive illustrations.
Wow, and that's
3 years.
Tough program. That's
yeah.
require a pretty strong portfolio to even get into the program. And I know from others that have taken the program, it's super intensive. It's a lot of work that goes into it.
It is. And the thing was, like, I was like one of the top artists in my high school. And so I thought, like, oh, like this, you know, like if you're talented, it should come naturally. So when I did my portfolio, to try out for Sheridan, I did it like the night before, and I got in by fluke because once I looked at who I was with, like I was like a small fish in a bigger pond. I was like, oh wow, like everyone here is like way better than me.
Wow.
Because it's like everyone in that program were like they were like the artistic people in their own high school, and now it's like an all-star game of all-star team of
cream of the crop.
Yeah, exactly.
That's hilarious. That's almost like a reverse morality tale where it's like you did everything wrong. And you did everything last minute, and yet somehow you still managed to get there and get through it. So
I pushed myself like for those 3 years to improve myself.
Yeah.
But then Larry Hama made me realize I need to push myself even harder to be a professional comic artist. Because I remember when I asked him about my work, I think one of the things he said was like, or one of the things he asked me was, so wait, did you go to art school? I was like,
wow.
Yeah, right?
Oh, wow.
Right?
You hear that after you just spent 3 years of hell drawing, like, probably, like, anatomy in every possible way you could imagine, and then he asked you that.
I was going, what are some of the things that worked that I can continue off? But he wanted me to, like, be aware of the things that I'm doing wrong.
Yeah.
He was like, I'm not going to tell you that.
Wow.
No, like look at, like, all the things you're doing wrong. Like all the dialogue scenes that I'm drawing are, like, he would say that like they could be puppets, like because you're not seeing their legs. And it's true because like it, like you're taking shortcuts just by doing like all these medium close up shots.
Yeah.
When you should be like doing these establishing shots, like just to tell a story around like the environment of where they're
absolutely actually
they are.
The guy that I would say is my most important mentor from a comics perspective is Ty Templeton.
Yeah.
Because I took courses with him, and he made a point of saying, he's like, in every page you should have a close up and a medium, like an action shot and an establishing shot. Doesn't matter which order, but they should be in every page, because like with the exception obviously of being, but like any like of like a full page spread or something. But you know, like, because that's gonna give you that movement, that dynamism, like, and because he was like it's just like a film or any sort of television or something, where in any act or any scene you're gonna have multiple perspectives. Like, you're gonna see it wide, you're gonna see it close, you're gonna see it medium, depending on the, you know, the context of what's going on.
Exactly.
And you know, like, it's, that's the same kind of sentiment really, where it's like you can't just keep going with the same shot over and over. Your reader's gonna get bored.
Yeah, and if you take those words out, it's like, oh, it's just people talking.
Yeah, why is it a comic?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. What is the story being, like, how is the story being told on the page, right? So,
And you gotta, like, there's also acting involved. Like, you gotta think about the gestures, like, how they're expressing themselves through the dialogue.
Which is such a challenge.
Yeah.
Like, but, wow, so he really gave you like an education after you had an education.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And the thing was, I remember like the first conversation I had with him, which was probably like a 2-hour talk. I was already on my knees, and I was like on a crossroads. Like, should I quit art right now?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I was glad. I had to think it over like overnight and. Again, the night after that, because there was like so much that he taught me, but through like this harsh criticism,
yeah, through the
like
most
just straight honest
way to hear,
yeah,
but it got you to where you needed to be.
Exactly.
So that's, I mean, that's fantastic. That's so cool that you got that experience from him. And did you have a connection to him, or did you just reach out? You just reached out to him and...
I did this a favor for a friend. Like, I was doing some pro bono artwork for this guy in the States, and he happens to be friends with Larry Hama, so he kind of set that up with me. Well, actually, what was one of the cool things before, like when he set up me and Larry Hama, like he asked Larry Hama to like send me some like an original drawing of Storm Shadow.
Oh wow.
Which was so awesome, and especially I still have the envelope because it has his home address. I was like, oh, I know where he lives. And whenever I go to New York, I can stop by and visit him.
Wow,
that's another story. I'm not gonna go in there.
You haven't dropped in on him yet?
Well, no, it's another story. I don't want to. It's horrible. But no, he's a good guy. But to shed some light to this, when I was doing the G.I. Joe comic for the Canadian convention, I gave him an issue, and it was like, so hey Larry, wanna see my latest work? And this was like back in like 2010, and like he was remembering what he saw before, and he was like, well, like there's definitely story, like I can definitely see what's going on.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, it's definitely an improvement. It's like, okay, I'll take that.
Yeah.
Take
wow.
It. Yeah.
Wow. He sounds like a harsh critic.
Yeah.
Man, but I mean, it sounds like the kind of person that sometimes you really need.
You need
at least
that.
One person like that. I mean, when I was in an art program, and
tough love.
You know what? We didn't get enough of that. That was the problem. Is I think that they were so worried about like the students sort of getting upset about not getting the experience they had hoped for, that you know a lot of people didn't improve as much as they really should have, and you know it was just it wasn't the right environment to really like break through those walls, because the truth is that, you know, you need to hear that stuff, and if you can't take it, you're really not cut out for
you,
it.
You have to, or else, like, you'll hear it from someone that's on the internet criticizing your work.
Which you did. Which is a perfect segue, actually, into the whole reason I brought you on, actually, which is, well, not the whole reason. I want a chance to talk to you because you're a really cool guy and all that, but,
thank you.
I mean, the timing, the reason why it's perfect to have you on now is that you have a Kickstarter campaign right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have the awesome comic coming up of the Pitiful Human Lizard.
Yep.
That's the name.
Toronto's new superhero.
Yes. And it looks super, super cool.
Thank you. Thank you. This is my homage to the old Marvel comics from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Again, throwing it old school.
Yeah.
Like just like, yeah, like Larry Hama has been teaching me, like, I've had this love of going to comic stores and like going to the dollar bins and finding some rare gems and just picking out like
weird old comics.
Yeah, like a Hero for Hire issue.
Cool.
And the thing that I've noticed about like those old Marvel comics was like they all took place in New York.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do the same thing in Toronto. So that's where the Pitiful Human Lizard came in.
Okay, so you figured like you wanted a Toronto-centric tale, like something where it really had the flavor of Toronto. But, I mean, clearly it's not a standard superhero tale. Like, the whole point is, like, this guy kind of sucks.
It was, like, just counter-marketing compared to, like, how, you know, Marvel has, like, their amazing Spider-Man, their mighty Thor, Incredible Hulk, and I have the Pitiful Human Lizard.
Yeah.
There was a bit of me into that character because I also have experienced a lot of like life's misfortunes and bad luck, and it's great to celebrate all that into a comic book, just telling a story through a superhero in the city that I love, Toronto.
Yeah. And I mean, it is a really cool way to showcase the city in an interesting, dynamic way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, with this story, is it going to be similar to something like Lou Harvest, where you're kind of adapting personal stories, or is this a very different story, but with a personal sense of the city?
Because
I know that's obviously a personal. I mean, we live in Toronto, so
it's not going to be as autobiographical like Lou Harvest. Like the character is its own, but does have some shades of me as well.
Sure.
This was actually a character that I've developed back in high school, back when I was doing the mini comics. I did a comic called Local Heroes Comics, and Human Lizard was one of the main characters, and it was about just a character that. A superhero that experiences a series of bad days. I was still working on it like through college as well, and I was going through an emo phase, so it just got very depressing. Because you would see the superhero just get beaten up and whatnot, like, you know, like he would just be like on his off duty time, just at a cafe and like. At a diner, and some villain's like, hey, you're the Human Lizard, right? Like, hey, you know what? Like, you don't look so tough. I'm pretty big. And he starts a fight with that guy.
Yeah,
and
like,
he gets beaten up.
Like, come on, man.
Yeah. And, you know, he doesn't have superpowers, so... so he gets a beating. And the same kind of goes in The Pitiful Human Lizard, but it's less depressing. It's a bit more comedic as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the setup, it just seems... perfect for like sort of a comic kind of a story, comedic story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so like the pinups that you got as part of the whole Kickstarter campaign are hysterical. Like, I mean, you've got the one of him washing his pants like at City Hall, like,
and his
cool
did that.
And him sitting on the streetcar, like on the TTC,
by Tishon Dwyer.
Yeah, and those things are it totally illustrates the humor that's in that concept.
Exactly. I told all the artists, like if they want to be part of this campaign. Like, you got to draw him in the most unflattering, embarrassing, humiliating situation in that pinup. Like, don't glorify him with a hero pose. No, there's tons of that. Leave that for Superman. Leave that for Batman. Whatever. This is the pitiful human lizard.
Yeah, that's not the like. That's not the kind of arena in which he excels. He's better at his worst.
Yeah,
essentially.
Exactly.
Which is, I mean, that's a fantastic concept. It really reminds me of stuff like The Tick. You know, like how all of those superheroes were pretty much clowns, except for The Tick, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, and like he just feels like he actually feels like he could totally fit into that universe, really.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is great. I mean, I don't know what you have in store for the story, but I can see the opportunity for just absurd villains, you know, and just ridiculous kind of story.
Yeah. Well, it's like, it's definitely not going to be, like, off-the-wall comedy like The Tick. Like, there's going to be, like, some realism, but it's not going to be as dark as, like, Kick-Ass.
Yeah. Fuck. I read that book, and I don't, like, as far as Mark Miller stuff goes, which I'm very polarized about, I'm like, I either love him or I hate him, it seems. That stuff was actually, Kick-Ass was all right, but it is, like, he just loves to, he revels in bad shit.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And Kick-Ass is one of those books where there are really light moments and it can be really kind of fun and touching. And then, like, his mom gets raped or something, you know? Like,
no, yeah. Yeah, there's
always
there's...
happens. And I think, like, it's refreshing to see a story where, you know, it's not all dark shit happening.
No.
You know, we have so much dark and gritty, like, comics and film. Like, we don't need it. We don't need any more of that shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, there is a light side to it. And I have this one super hero in the comic called Mother Wonder, who's like, she's a mother, but she's also a fantastic superhero as well. And the thing is, like, if this was, like, written by Mark Millar, like you'd probably explore, like that, you know, she has, like, a dual identity. Like,
yeah.
Like, the bad guy would probably want to, like, do
for her kid.
Exactly.
It's the obvious route he would take. Either that or he'd make her a dominatrix. Like, he's that weird. But
that's going to be avoided.
Yeah,
where,
exactly.
Where, like, people can look past that and probably go, like, you know what? She's so powerful that the bad guys won't even, like, they would be too intimidated to even, like, threaten her family because, like, she's that powerful and intimidating.
And, you know, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, sometimes you just accept that that's just not a part of the story you're telling, you know? I mean, if this is something where you're writing 300 issues of The Pitiful Human Lizard, yeah, maybe you
explore
have to take a look at that story.
Exactly.
But you're doing, I mean, it's a 52-page story, the first issue?
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, you can tell a very pure, clean story in that kind of an arc, which is nice. And then from there, I mean, you could potentially do more. Is that something that you were...
At least another 4 issues will be made. I do have, like, a pretty good ending to an arc.
Yeah.
But it's definitely not, like, an ending to The Human Lizard.
No, it's the first tale.
Yeah, exactly. The reason why I released a 52-page first issue was because I just wanted to throw as much as I could out there. So, like, in case if it was not a success, at least I told a one-shot story about him.
Yeah.
And people would already get a great feel for him. In a comic, like, besides following the Human Lizard, like, you also look at some of the people in the city of Toronto and like, what their thoughts are on the Human Lizard. Some think that, oh, he's just this guy who's just doing it for the fame and attention.
Yeah.
Like, just the cynics.
Yeah, of course.
And then there's, like, you know, the kids that look up to him like Superman, like he's wearing a cape and whatever.
I mean, it's like, Spider-Man is obviously another parallel hero of something like that, where it's that very grounded in reality, not just about the hero, but the reaction to the hero. It's the environment around the hero.
Yeah, like, right? Like, where, like, Captain Canuck is kind of like Captain America, like, my character's like Spider-Man, but the thing is, he's less amazing when he's a superhero, because he doesn't have, like, those enhanced powers that Spider-Man does, and he doesn't have the Mary Jane, so he's also out there trying to look for love as well. He doesn't have a love interest.
Yeah, well, maybe that'll come in issues to come.
He has his parents. He talks to his parents on the phone, so that also interferes.
He doesn't live in their basement.
Central love life. No, no, he lives in Parkdale,
which is that seems fitting for a pitiful human lizard.
Well, while his like parents are like well off in Queens Quay.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there. Living good in a nice fancy condo or something.
Yeah.
That's so good. It's a great premise. And I mean, the Kickstarter campaign's doing really well. You're at, like, I think last I checked, you're around 90% or 85%.
Close. Like 89 or something.
And you still got what? How, at the time of airing this, we're going to be going on, with about 2 weeks to go.
Okay.
I'll say. So, I mean, at that point, you're pretty close to hitting your goal.
I have like $500, exactly $500 left to raise.
Yeah. I mean, it's totally reasonable. And hopefully anyone listening to this, like, I admittedly haven't supported it yet. I am supporting it without question. I'm picking up a copy of this book. And anyone listening should definitely check it out as well. The URL I'll obviously include in the notes, but just a shout out what it is. It's kickstarter.com/...
Oh, it's easier if you go to the Facebook page. It's facebook.com/... Pitiful Human Lizard. I have like every post that I've had lately, like whether it's like posting an image, like I would actually have a link to the Kickstarter.
Okay, so like there's gonna be no issue if you go there. There's gonna be no
issue. There's tons of links to the Kickstarter. Yeah, so just go to the Facebook page.
And in terms of like using Kickstarter as a format, I mean, it's clearly working out well for you. Was there anything that you tried to be mindful of when approaching it? Because I mean, crowdsourcing is a difficult thing for people, and I'm always curious to hear from people that, especially someone like yourself that seems to be doing it pretty successfully. Like, what do you think was important when you were setting it up?
So this was like my first crowdfunding. I wasn't that scared as some of my friends thought, like, because like I was actually prepared with enough material to like to back people up, because when I look at like other Kickstarters, comic projects, like some of them like would only like they would like the project would result to like a 30-page comic, but they haven't drawn anything yet.
Yeah.
The script hasn't been made. Like they only have like just concept art, whatever. And it's like. Yeah. I want to make sure I can give the fans a guarantee that this is going to be done. Like, this here is something, here's a promise that you're going to get a Toronto superhero.
Yeah.
Just.
It's happening.
It's happening. Yeah. Like, I'm going to try to have it made, like, whether you like it or not. Like, if the crowdfund was not a success, I would probably just be making a low run copies of the comic. Like it would just be
a personal small print run.
Yeah, but I would really appreciate making like 1,000 copies for me to like distribute around the city and nationwide, because this is another new Canadian superhero.
Yeah, which I mean, and like you said before, well, what we were talking about before, it's really expensive to produce a good quality product and to get it well printed, to not get it Xeroxed.
Exactly.
You know, like,
it's
gonna cost some money. So that I mean it was a very reasonable goal. I think it's like what about close to 5,000. It's like
45,000. Yeah, that includes like the production and the shipping, and any compensation I would have to provide for some of the contributing artists that were doing the pinups.
Yeah, of course, because you know, you got to
Kalman
and
Drzasowski's.
Kalman and Drzasowski. That's a big guy to be getting. That's Mr. Captain Canuck.
Exactly. So, I've known that guy for a while, and it was great when he was following like some of my posts before the Kickstarter, and I was like, Kalman, would you want to be a part of this campaign? And then he was like, yeah, wouldn't it be, yeah, like, I love it. Like, wouldn't it be awesome to see, like, the Human Lizard, like, team up with Captain Canuck? I was like, yes!
Do it!
I would love that! Yeah!
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, it's cool because, I mean, one thing that I always think is kind of tricky is the goals, or sorry, not the goals, the targets or the pledge amounts in terms of what you're giving people back. And I think you said it pretty reasonably in that I think, like, basically at the $15 point, you're giving people a book.
The book and a digital copy, and it's going to be shipped right to their door. So the shipping's included.
And so, I mean, that's obviously huge. Did you find it was, like, kind of tough to crunch the numbers on that? Or were, like how did you feel about putting together those, like, rewards, like the perk levels?
I was looking at other Kickstarter campaigns that were successful, like True Patriot and Novana.
Which, I mean, both very similar. I mean, both Canadian superhero projects, right? Yeah. Novana being a little different because it's really more curatorial. I mean, they're restoring pages, but it's all completed work that's being, you know, put together. But True Patriot, when I saw your book, I thought of True Patriot. Hell, I thought to myself, I'm like, why isn't this in True Patriot? But you get the luxury of being able to tell a bigger story.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess they didn't really know much about me.
Yeah. Maybe they'll be asking for me to contribute on True Patriot.
We'll see. I'll love to see like a short in.
Yeah, human lizard. Or the pitiful human lizard. He needs to be in there. You know, for all those guys. Who is it?
Please.
Yeah. Jay Torres and Ramon Perez, you guys take
it. But it's all right. I have my own sandbox.
There you go. You've got your own world to play in. But True Patriot's actually a really cool thing in the sense of, like, it's a cool pilot. I'd really love to see something like that where those guys actually start, like, some of those guys expand and tell their own stories. Like, a couple of my buddies worked on it. Adam Gorham
and
Frank Kennedy. Both of them were fantastic guys. Actually,
they didn't, like, that was one of my favorite stories in the True Patriot.
The blue noser or whatever. It was a fun, crazy tale. She had seagull hands.
Yeah.
It's just like, who does that?
And her weakness was like, tuna sandwich.
Exactly. It's, you know, it was a fun romp, but like, it's similar in a sense to like your, like in your story with Pitiful Human Lizard.
Does it take itself seriously?
It's comedic. It's light. It's kind of absurd. It's also hugely Canadian. It's very East, like Maritimes. Yeah, I mean, like, why couldn't that be its own book, right? So it's cool to see. I mean, I think we're at a time, especially in Toronto, where you've got a lot of original content and you got a lot of amazing creators. I don't think there's ever been a time where Toronto's had this many top-notch comic book creators.
And it's a good time right now it seems like a new dawning for Canadian superheroes. Like,
absolutely.
With Novana being reprinted, and then there is even talks that there's going to be like a new Novana series by some of the local artists from Toronto.
Which would be very cool.
And there's a new Captain Canuck cartoon and a comic that's going to be coming out. True Patriots and their second volume.
There's the web series Heroes of the North, which is a, you know, it's its own thing as well.
Which my friend Chris Yao is part of.
Yeah,
and he's also
Chris
a contributing
as well. He's a dude I've been talking about getting on here as well. But Chris is fantastic. And a really, really skilled illustrator as well.
He rocks it on those sketch covers.
Sketch covers? Oh my God. Yeah, he's the guy who can do them all day. I think he would do them all day if he could get paid.
He needs like a gallery of them.
I know. He practically has one over at the Comic Book Lounge.
Yeah.
But, I think it is. It's a good time for Canadian superheroes, and it's a good time to support your Kickstarter campaign. Because,
please.
I mean, we've got, like, at the time this is going up, you got 2 weeks to get it. You should definitely get on it. I mean, do you have any stretch goals in mind if it does hit its target? Not to get cocky, but...
If it reaches 6,000, like, people, like, everyone who will receive anything in the mail will get an exclusive a Pitiful Human Lizard print in the same fashion as like, my variant covers, where, like, you'll see them in a classic Toronto landmark, like
you have the Honest Ed's,
or Chinatown.
Yeah.
So you'll get something like that. If it reaches like 8,000, I'm gonna make 2,000 copies, and just go around the convention circuits across Canada. Like, I'm hoping to go to Montreal and Ottawa to even promote this comic as well.
Awesome, yeah. So get the book in as many hands as possible, which is a very admirable goal and definitely worthwhile. So, you know, everyone listening to this, you should definitely check it out. We're kind of up on time, unfortunately.
Oh, wow.
So we're gonna wrap up. But, yeah, check out The Pitiful Human Lizard. It's on Facebook right now. Go to the Kickstarter page. Support it. Get the book. Jason, it's been awesome having you on.
It's been my pleasure, Eric. Yeah. It's made it so simple for me. This felt so natural. Like, I just had, like, a video.
So there you have it, Jason Liu. What'd I tell you? Awesome guy, really fun to talk to. Clearly knows his stuff, like the story he wants to tell, which was really good to see. I mean, there's clearly a guy with, you know, a real vision to what he wants to make. And yeah, I mean, I really had a good time talking to him. And if it's not obvious already, you should definitely support the Kickstarter campaign. It's the Facebook, like you said, it's facebook.com/pitifulhumanlizard. No the there, so don't throw any these in there, all right? And then as well, you can follow him on Twitter. It's @rebel_Lou. So R-E-B-E-L underscore L-O-O. Of course, that's all in the notes and everything. You can find that. But there you go. As we speak, the Kickstarter campaign has just hit its goal. It is at 4,500 right now, exactly on the dot, which means it's the perfect time to support it because you know you're getting a copy. So I'm going to be picking up a copy. You should pick up a copy. With a little luck, maybe he'll hit some stretch goals and we'll get more cool shit. So there you go. That was Jason Liu, and I'm looking forward to checking out The Pitiful Human Lizard in comic book stores maybe near you. I don't know. It depends on where you are. It's not going to be that big a release, let's face it. But it's going to be really cool.